ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
On Conversations today, a real treat. We're bringing you highlights from our live storytelling event at the 2024 Adelaide Writers Week. We chose the theme Family Circus because, as we hear time and time again on Conversations, families can yield the richest, the strangest, and the funniest stories of all. So we invited a bunch of Australian writers to share a reflection on their own family. You'll hear from Wendy Harmer, Christos Tsolkas, Lisa Miller, Martin Flanagan, and from our very own Richard Feidler. I was there as ringmaster of this family circus, wrangling the writers and a very excitable sold-out audience in the magnificent surrounds of the Adelaide Town Hall. And in a way, this role is familiar to me. After all, I'm the youngest of seven opinionated children. But at least at this gathering, everyone was fairly well behaved. To start us off, a woman who has been, I think, in all of our homes over the years, whether via the TV, the radio, or as a writer, the irrepressible Wendy Harmer. Wendy's memoir is the wonderfully titled Lies My Mirror Told Me.
When I sat down to write my book, it took me a long time to get round to writing it for one reason. And the opening line I have for my book was, my mother has always threatened to sue me if I wrote my memoir, so if you are now reading this, I will assume she has been unsuccessful. And Richard said, that is the great opening line, you must use that, but the lawyers said no. But so she's come round. If you're listening now, Mum, she will be from Tassie. We've found a rapprochement after all this time. My friend and fellow author and broadcaster Richard Glover says that he often finds himself in dinner parties with who has the weirdest parents competitions. He usually wins. Now, my parents were not weird. My father was a teacher at isolated country schools. My mother worked in factories and eventually became a nurse. But during my childhood, they both went AWOL. My father didn't so much fake his absence as fake his presence. My mother staged her own suicide when I was 10 with my younger brothers and sisters as witnesses. She went to Tasmania and never came back. Dad, at the age of 32, with four young kids, ran off the rails, and we kids were left to our own devices for much of the time, and with me as surrogate mum. I had my own extra struggles to deal with as the funny-looking kid in the wrong colour school uniform, because Dad liked to move around a lot, and I'd be at a school and Dad was the teacher. So it was really the trifecta. Thank you very much. Now, the thing that people remark upon when they read my book is they talk about resilience. They say, you seem to be a very resilient person. And that's what I'd like to touch on today. Now, babies are not born resilient. It's not a genetic trait. Yes, some are predisposed to experience stress more than others. It may be harder for some kids to attach, whatever, whatever. But more and more scientific evidence tells us that there is one factor above all which makes the difference between a child who can adapt, overcome, and become resilient, and that is a stable and committed relationship with a supportive adult. Now, if that doesn't come from mum and dad, that relationship which develops resilience can remarkably come from one person, one adult. It's amazing to me to think that one person can make that difference to a child. Now, I count myself very lucky to have had an extended family who supported me. They lived quite a way away in Ballarat, and I lived in, probably about 5 hours' drive from them, my aunts and my grandmother. And, of course, there were my four siblings. We were very, very tight because we thought we would have to go off to an orphanage. So we bonded very tightly. Now, what happens, I'm fascinated by this, what happens when mum and dad can't keep up their end of the bargain that society has mandated? So often they can't keep up with that bargain to love their kids and support them and be together through no particular fault of their own. And mine, for instance, were both good people with the best of intentions. Now, there's been plenty written about the mistake of the so-called nuclear family and how this family structure that we have held up as the cultural ideal for the last past half a century or so has failed so many of us. We almost fetishise this most fragile of human inventions, mum, dad and the kids. In Australia, we have moved from big extended families into smaller and smaller units. There are 1.5 million people in Australia who live in one-parent households. Now, I'm no way of saying that those households aren't functioning and those parents aren't doing a mighty job, but perhaps it is time that we revisit building those extended families of years gone by, the ones that many migrant families strive to recreate when they come to live in Australia, the ones that still flourish against all the odds in First Nation communities when uncles and aunties belong to everyone. When we look at the housing crisis in our cities, there are very few options for extended families to live together. Instead, we have flats or apartments, or we have small townhouses, duplexes, small homes divided by fences and isolated from community spaces, aged care facilities, and not a lot in between. My husband is from one of those vanishing households that had his grandmother live with them until the day she died. Yes, her presence was often exhausting and demanding, but she was there as that one extra person, an insurance policy, if you like, for building resilience in that most brittle of constructions, the nuclear family. The title of today's session is The Family Circus. How did old-time carny folk travel? In caravans, maybe young and old, all in together. Lots of drama, for sure, but always someone there, someone to confide in. And personally, I can vouch for the freedom that kids enjoy with no mum and dad around. It really is tremendous fun. I know it's heresy to say it. Me, we had a good time. It was amazing. Just went out wherever. Anyway, I won't. Anyway. An essay by David Brooks, the Canadian social commentator, writing in The Atlantic magazine a few years ago, put it rather eloquently. We have a significant opportunity, a chance to thicken and broaden family relationships, a chance to allow more adults and children to live and grow under the loving gaze of a dozen pairs of eyes and be caught when they fall by a dozen pairs of arms. For decades, we have been eating at smaller and smaller tables with fewer and fewer kin. It's time to find ways to bring back the big tables. Thank you.
Now, last year, I had the great honour of speaking with Martin Flanagan on Conversations about his tremendously moving and exquisitely written memoir, The Empty Honour Board. It's a book that makes you cry, then laugh, then cry again. And so will this reflection on Martin's late mother.
My mother died in 2014. I wrote this piece about her 3 years ago on my birthday. You would have seen the paddocks on the river flat from your hospital room, Mum. Cows with their snouts in the grass. You would have seen the rough blue line of Mount Arthur to the east. The mountain's still there, Mum. So are the cows. But Queen Victoria Hospital is not a hospital anymore. It's some sort of office. I stand outside its glass doors. Somewhere near here, you and I performed the prodigious athletic feat of birth, Mum. My two daughters were born in the same hospital. I attended both births. I know what it looks like, the arrival of a new human being, the strain, the splitting open, a head nudging into sight, then this grey-purple package squirts forth. Today's my birthday. 66 years ago, this is where it happened, Mum, where I slipped into the world and lay like a dazzled fish. The northwest of Tasmania, where Mum grew up, has colours that compete to dance with your eyeballs. Red soil, grass lush green. On a fine day to the north, Bass Strait wears a necklace of sparkling light. To the south is a gothic purple shape called Mount Roland. You loved the place you were from, Mum. Your stories about it are told and retold. They're like a campfire we warm ourselves around. You and I butted heads over religion early on, fought a war, to be frank, but in the end we just had fun. Every year on grand final day I rang you from the MCG, plugging you into the electricity of the big day. It was Mum who taught me to kick a footy. She hated Carlton because Wes Lofts played for Carlton and he hit Peter Hudson, and Peter Hudson was Tasmanian. And we were Tasmanian. Mum was about loyalty first, second and third. She couldn't stand the Liberals, including the one she called Fatty Downer. Guess what, Mum? Just before the 2020 election, US presidential election, Fatty Downer announced he would have voted for Trump. No surprises there, eh, Mum? At one book signing, a man lined up to tell me he got a lift with Mum on the west coast of Tasmania in the 1960s. The unsealed road was wet and muddy. He said you went into a slide, Mum. He found himself looking down the side of a mountain and blanched at the memory. He said you drove your way out of it, Mum, laid off the brakes, hit the accelerator when needed. He told me you drove trucks during the war. You didn't, but as one of my brothers said, you would have loved to. You lived to be 94. In your last year, my brother Richard made the long list of 13 for the Man Booker Literary Prize. My sisters told Mum. She said he's won. My sisters patiently sought to explain he'd made the last 13. That was an achievement we could all be proud of, and Mum said, no, he's won it. Same thing happened when he made the shortlist. Then you died and came back to life. I got a text in Melbourne to say you had stopped showing vital signs and then revived. I rang and got you on the phone. You were deaf by this time, so I had to shout, Mum, it's Mart. How are you? And from your deathbed you cried, elated. Richard's won the prize. A few weeks later, when he did win it, she received the news like she was being told yesterday's weather. You had an adventurous spirit, Mum, but you married a man who didn't want to leave the backyard after what he'd experienced during the war. So you lived through the adventures of your kids. You loved what the Irish called the crack, the hum of a happy room. We made sure there was crack at your deathbed, Mum. Lots of bright talk and chatter. Thanks, everyone, you said. I've had a lovely time. They were your last words. I wrote a book with Michael Long. Michael says the silliest thing white fellas say is that you can't talk to the dead. His mother died when he was 13. He still has a cup of tea with her every day. He says she was with him during the 1993 grand final when he won the Norm Smith medal. I believe that stuff. That's why I came to my birthplace today, Mum. I knew I'd find you here.
Broadcast and online. This is Conversations with Sarah Kanoski on ABC Radio. Subscribe to the Conversations podcast. To find out more, just head to abc.net.au/conversations.
ABC TV journalist Lisa Miller, who's now Australia's favourite dog wrangler, wrote about her sprawling family in her memoir, Daring to Fly. In Adelaide, she took us behind the scenes of that, sharing just how tricky memory can be when you've got to share it among a bunch of siblings.
There are five of us, born across 22 years. Robert, David, Wendy, me, and the youngest, Trudy. It's led to an unusual dynamic because my brother was getting married before I'd even started school. Robert became a grandfather before my younger sister, Trudy, even had her first child. I'd always prided myself on being the wordsmith of the family, but when it came to writing my memoir, I had to ask myself, was I the custodian of all their stories? So the book project for Daring to Fly started with a WhatsApp family chat, and it was filled with the back and forth of anecdotes of country childhoods. But I was surprised that there was dissension about how I might interpret some of the memories that were being shared for the written stage. One of them involved what is always regarded, well, I'd always regarded it, as a great Miller family triumph at the Kilkeven Showgrounds. My older sister Wendy had been something of a tomboy, taking her horse Angus and disappearing for hours as she roamed the countryside. When she was 13, she decided to enter the horse riding competition at the annual show. She'd borrowed another horse because she was worried that Angus wasn't up to the task of winning a ribbon. And so when the judges called her out from the circle of prancing riders, no one was surprised, except when they declared her with great flourish the best boy rider. She stuck out her chest and informed them she was not, in fact, a boy. That was news to the judges, who then sent her back into the ring only to announce her moments later as best girl rider. She got the blue velvet ribbon and the dollar coin, and Dad would tell everyone that it only went to show she was the very best rider on the day, but it didn't stop us teasing her long after she was a grown woman. Those paragraphs out of the book were edited to an inch of their life by Wendy, 50 years after the event, who was, unbeknownst to us, still carrying embarrassment. My brother David was the joker in the family. He would return home for short visits when I was a toddler. Enough time to plonk me on the handlebars of his motorbike, deliberately roaring past Mum's tennis ladies, revving the engine just enough to drown out the tisking. So I'd sent each of my siblings multiple versions of the manuscript. It wasn't until it was actually ready for the printers that Robert, the eldest responsible one, inquired, did David know I was writing about his near expulsion from boarding school? Something that had prompted our dairy farming dad to drop tools and make the 4-hour trek to Brisbane to plead for leniency. I sent David all the manuscripts, I responded genuinely. Turned out he'd read none. The siblings had been surprised that the story involving girls and a swimming pool had made it through so many drafts with David's seemingly silent approval. So could I share the details then? It was funny, no? You know? The custodian of family stories was firmly told that was not to be written. Mum and Dad had attended the Anglican Church in Kilkeven when they'd first arrived in the 1950s. It was a white wooden building, sporting a couple of small crosses above its doors and lacking any of the stained glass windows or embellishments you'd find in bigger towns. Robert, David and Wendy all went to Sunday school and they threw themselves into it with such vigour that Robert and Wendy became junior instructors. But the church coffers weren't in great shape, and the pastor suggested Dad might like to add a little more to the plate if he wanted to guarantee a proper burial under God's gaze. Well, Dad, then only in his late 30s, wasn't planning on dying anytime soon, and he was also dead broke. So my parents packed up their Bibles and moved down the road to the Union Church, where their meagre but enthusiastic contributions to the weekly plate and the church community weren't questioned. Huh, how about that? I never knew, I responded when the family WhatsApp chat landed on our parents' belief in a higher being and what life moments had caused it to ebb and flow. I was learning something all the time from my siblings. Who knew that writing a book would spark more group conversations than we'd had in years? We'd always had something in common, and that was flying, a love of it, sparked by my dad and the introduction of another member of the family when I was just 2, a 4-seater Piper Cherokee named after our grandmother. There never seemed to be a time when my family didn't talk about flying. Dad had wanted to be an aviator in World War II, but it wasn't until he was in his 40s that he got his pilot's license. My eldest brother Robert learned to fly. My older brother, David, always the contrary one, he preferred to jump out of planes. My big sister, Wendy, dreamed of being an international flight attendant, and my little sister was the happiest of passengers. Me, I was from the very first takeoff. I loved being airborne. When I finished my years as a foreign correspondent, I was asked to be a guest on Conversations. I wondered on air, what had happened to our little flying machine over the 4 decades since Dad had sold her? Well, guess what? A listener, Dave, thanks Dave, emailed the program and he said, hey, tell Lisa I used to own her family's plane and I nearly crashed it. And so when I came to write a memoir finally, to tell the stories of our family, it turned out Conversations had given me one of the final chapters. With Dad now gone, but the memories of our childhood and his dreams still rich in our minds, Dave's email sparked a search across Australia that uncovered a succession of owners. It ended on a road trip with Wendy to a hangar in a town about 40 minutes from where India Echo Charlie had started her flying life in country Queensland half a century earlier. We circled the plane from tail to nose and back again. There was a new engine and a paint job, and remarkably to Wendy and myself, she was still flying. So I sent dozens of photos to the family chat. Look who we found, I asked excitedly and told them. Yeah, she looked a little bit older, a little worn out around the edges. But who were we kidding? So were we.
you.
Lisa Miller. Next in our family circus, Christos Tsolkas. Christos has been writing about family his whole career, most famously in The Slap, in which a family barbecue sets off a series of relationship explosions. For our family circus event, Christos read from his latest novel, The In-Between.
This passage I'm going to read is a homage to my uncle Dimitri. My dad was one of 12 children. After he left to come here in 1955, he and Dimitri only saw each other twice. And that was when Dad went back to bury a parent. But the love they had for each other was and remained immense. A robotic female voice announces, first in Greek and then in English, that the train is arriving at Anupatasia. The students make their way to the doors and Lena follows. Daphne and Thymios, for that is the name of the old woman and the old man, are silent all the way to Neoraklio. They are exhausted. It is the anniversary of Daphne's brother's burial and they have spent the day with their sister-in-law, Aleki, in Calithea. Visitors keep turning up throughout the afternoon. Daphne helped with the preparations for lunch, made the coffees and served the sweets and drinks to those who had dropped by. Thymios, who had been a carpenter, cleaned and reinserted the exhaust in the bathroom and fixed the door in Aleki's bedroom. The wood had buckled over the years and it was not shutting properly. Yet it wasn't their labours that had proved most tiring. In fact, Daphne in the kitchen and Thymios unbolting and sanding down the door, screwing it back in place, had found it almost a relief to be working. It was the endless chatter, the conversations and the reminiscence that had been arduous. Daphne misses her brother. She had been his favourite from when they were children in the village. He indulged her and protected her. When she had moved to Athens as a young girl, she had lived with him and Aleki. She worries about her sister-in-law. Aleki is nearly 90 and has one son in Frankfurt and the other in Thessaloniki. They are good boys. Hierosimos has never married, but whenever he returns from Germany, he seems content. And he has his health. That's really what matters. She thinks of her own daughter, of how broken and angry her child has been since the divorce. That fury is no good. Daphne fears it is eating her child from the inside out. No life is simple and no life is without sorrow and no life is perfect. She looks at her husband, this balding man, his once strong hands withered from a creeping arthritis, his heavy belly. How good looking he had been, lithe and capable and strong and handsome. She shifts in her seat, moving closer to him. She can't bear the thought of losing him. She thinks she will be maddened by that loss. Terrible, morbid thoughts. She quickly crosses herself, asks for God's forgiveness. What's wrong? Nothing, she says, her tone harder than she meant it to be. I was thinking of Pano. Yes. Thymios sits quietly, then wipes a tear from his eye. He loved his brother-in-law. They had been true friends. There is a loud music in the square at Neoeraklion. The taverns and cafes are full of young people. No one takes any notice of the two old people walking past. Daphne and Thymios follow the train line, then turn into the street. There is the odd rumble of a truck from the distant highway, the weak throb of electronic music from the square. But the night encroaches. The old couple walk into the shadows. There is a glimpse of them, side by side, Daphne deliberately slowing her pace so that her husband won't be humiliated by trying to keep up. They are there, a faint silhouette in the black of the night, impossible to tell where one ends and the other begins. There is that faint impression. Then there is the merging, the disappearing, and the belonging to the night.
Christos Tsolkas. Podcast. Broadcast. This is Conversations with Sarah Konoski. Hear more conversations anytime on the ABC Listen app. Now, our last storyteller needs little introduction. It's our own beloved Richard Feidler, this time wearing his author hat and sharing a family story and some insight into his parenting style.
I want to talk about fatherhood today, and I'm going to begin with a quote which is at the start of my first book, Ghost Empire. I rather pompously or pretentiously quoted Umberto Eco, who wrote, "I believe that what we become depends on what our fathers teach us at odd moments when they aren't trying to teach us. We are formed by little scraps of wisdom." I'm going to read something from Ghost Empire, which is a history of the Byzantine Empire, or the later Roman Empire, as it's probably more properly called, a book that's also mixed with a travel memoir, because in 2014, my son had turned 14, and I wanted to have some kind of a coming-of-age event with him. And us white Irish Australians don't really have coming-of-age rituals other than drinking a pint of Guinness in a pub somewhere, which his mother wasn't too keen on, for Joe at the age of 14. And because he loved history so much, as I do, we went on a bit of an adventure to see the beginning and end of the Roman Empire in Rome and in Istanbul, which was once the great imperial city of Constantinople. Heavenly cities, doomed emperors, robotic trees, crusaders, saints, floating nuns, and the ever-looming apocalypse. It was this rich stew of stories that had brought me to Istanbul with Joe. Our common enjoyment of history was a source of quiet and deep joy to me. It wasn't hard to infect him with the history bug. Even as a small boy, Joe was looking to place himself in the great long stream of events and people, needing to understand what had taken place before his entry into the world. The long, long story of the ancient Romans appealed to him as much as me. For some reason, men and boys tend to talk more freely side by side rather than face to face. So when Joe was little, I often took him on long walks with me. On these walks, he would pepper me with questions about the Nazis and the Industrial Revolution. By the time he was 12, we'd moved on to the Russo-Japanese War and the Cuban Missile Crisis. Outside Istanbul's Blue Mosque, Joe is intrigued by a cart selling something called salep. I order two cups and we're presented with a creamy hot drink. I hand a paper cup to Joe, who takes a long, slow sip. He closes his eyes and smiles, like he's just found something he's been looking for. "Right," he says emphatically, "I want to have salep every day while we're here." Salep is a gooey mixture of milk, rice flour, sugar, and rose water, but the crucial ingredient is derived from the tubers of wild orchids, which are washed, boiled, dried, and ground. The milky concoction is poured into a cup and garnished with cinnamon or crushed pistachios. Turkish people claim that salep is a medicinal drink, effective against all kinds of complaints, including bronchitis and heart disease, but Joe and I are happy to drink it for the sweet contentment it brings on a cold morning. That night, we tell Yassine, the desk clerk at our hotel, how much we love salep. "Salep is no big deal," he says. "The really great thing to have in Istanbul is kaymak." Yassine scrawls a name on a post-it note. "Pando kaymak. The best kaymak is here," he says quietly. And so the next day, Joe and I walk down to Eminönü to catch a ferry to the crowded inner city suburb of Beşiktaş on the European shore of the Bosphorus. Beşiktaş is now a gentrified shopping precinct with kebab shops, mobile phone outlets and burger joints. Joe and I find our way to the cobalt blue shopfront. This modest cafe is an institution in Istanbul, like Pellegrini's in Melbourne or Veselka in New York City. Run down but spick and span, informal but charismatic. The clientele is a mixture of old-timers and young Turkish hipsters. Joe and I take a seat at the marble-top table as an ancient man shuffles past, tentatively carrying a plate of eggs. This is the proprietor, Pando, a man in his 90s with close-cropped hair and white whiskers. Pando and his wife, Dona, are some of the few remaining Greek Christians in Istanbul. Clustered on the walls are framed photos of Pando's proud ancestors, mustachioed men with burgundy fezzes perched on their heads. Pando's Cafe and Cream Shop was founded in 1895. He was born and raised in this cramped two-story building. As a boy in the 1920s, he met Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, who came by and shook his hand. The cafe now serves a delicious breakfast of fried eggs and sausages washed down with tea or Turkish coffee, but people mostly come here for the kaymak, which I discover is a kind of clotted cream formed from buffalo milk. It's a traditional Turkish food originating from Central Asia. Dona, his wife, comes to our table. She wears an apron over her black cardigan, and her grey hair is pulled back into a bun. She bows her head with a degree of old-world formality and smiles at us, ready to take our order. Now, I have no Turkish, so I grin apologetically and point at the items on the laminated menu and say, querulously, "Kaymak, Turkish coffee?" Dona smiles. "Avec du sucre?" she inquires. A little taken aback, I reply, "Yes, I mean, oui." She's speaking French to me, this lovely Greek grandmother in Istanbul. "Vous êtes américain?" she inquires politely. "No, madame," I stutter, summoning my schoolboy French. "Nous venons de l'Australie." "Ah, mon mari et mon cousin à Melbourne. Ah, je suis né à Melbourne." She jots down the order. "Alors, deux plats de kaymak et café turc avec du sucre." "Merci, madame." She smiles and withdraws. Joe is agog. "We've been here all this time and you speak fluent Turkish." I arch an eyebrow enigmatically. It's so hard to impress a teenage son. Thank you.
A big thanks to all our writers. And thank you from me to my six siblings, Peter, Meg, John, Helen, Philip and Paul. And to my mum and dad, Peter and Maureen, who, despite raising us all, are somehow still going strong. I'm Sarah Kanoski. Thanks for being part of our Conversations family, and thanks for listening.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Sarah Kanoski. For more Conversations interviews, head to the website abc.net.au/conversations.